I'd like to thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Peter Pappas, and we're here to learn about the power of digital publishing. While the title of the workshop references struggling readers and writers, you'll see quite quickly this is useful for all kids. So don't be misled by that. Just to give you an idea, I've been doing, this is one of four workshops that I'm doing here, so you've already missed a couple of them, but if you happen to attend the ones on rigor, relevance, and reading for either struggling readers or high-performing readers, rest assured this is not a repeat of that. So you're in for some new material. Secondly, right after this in this room, I'm doing a workshop on ninth grade academies, which also is very different from this one. So feel free to drop back for that. The work I'm doing, I think, is very well aligned with the program as defined in Reading Next and the work that's being done in the state ed department as far as promoting the whole idea of how do you teach content and support literacy at the same time. So I think you'll see I'm closely aligned to that. I'm also going to be using the rigor and relevance model, and I'll be telling you more about that. But before I do, I need to introduce myself. I was a high school social studies teacher for 25 years and worked in a variety of districts. I've got another social studies teacher here in the front row. Worked in a very small district, K-12, 300 kids, senior class of a dozen. Very rural, as you might imagine. A suburban district, an urban district, so I've had a number of different experiences. And about 25 years into my teaching career, which I was having a great time, and I think very, very successful at it, the district I was with wanted to create a position of part-time coordinator of social studies, teacher on special assignment. Nobody wanted the job. I said, okay, I'll take it. And so I did, and so I was on a 4/10 release doing that or something. And then my superintendent said, you know, you should really think about being a school administrator. And I thought, well, this is kind of silly. It's a little late for that. I said, you know, I've got to go back and take more classes, and, you know, I'm going to be 50. And, of course, he pointed out I was going to be 50 anyway. So I did take the classes, which is a story in and of itself, and then managed to come out of the program and get a job as an assistant superintendent for instruction in yet another district, which I did for 5 years, and then retired from that. So I'm actually out of the New York State system now. But I continue to live in Rochester, New York, and I've really sort of ramped up another side of my career, which has been as a writer and a trainer and a consultant, which I really began about 20 years ago when I realized that I didn't want to stand on a ladder all summer and paint houses. So I started doing some other things that were more educationally related, got to work with a lot of different organizations. About 10 years ago, I was recruited by Willard Daggett and the International Center to come and work with them, which I do. And so I've got a pretty active involvement outside of what I called my day job there as a teacher and administrator. The reason my website address is up here is it's a very useful resource for you. In fact, a lot of what I'll be sharing with you today will be available online. I get on average about 1,000 visitors a day, so that's well over 300,000 a year. And I think they're there because I've got a lot of material online, and it's just there for the taking. So I've got a whole nother, I guess, career as an online teacher, even though I'm not actually teaching classes. I'm just offering resources. Now, one of the sections of that site is called Read, Think, Write, Publish, and that really references the work that I'll be sharing with you today. So you can go there and get some resource material. Also, if you're interested in any information regarding me coming to work with your district, because I work all over the country, you can certainly drop me an email. The other thing is that if you just have a question or something you want to send an email, do. But please put something in the title line other than, you know, chewable Viagra or something like that, because I won't open it. Can you actually chew that stuff? I don't know, but I've gotten ones with that on it. Anyway, you know, you got to have a blog. So, of course, I have a blog in addition to my website. And what I will be doing is taking an updated version of the PowerPoint that you have, because I had to submit this like a month ago, and I've already come up with new stuff since. So There'll be a more modern version of that that you can download. Also, I'm audio taping this, and if you really want to punish yourself and listen to this for another hour, you could do that. Or put it on your iPod and take me to the gym with you or something for your workout. Okay. Now, as far as the agenda goes, I will be talking about rigor and relevance with a bit of an introduction as to what that model looks like. Certainly commenting on what I think is a very profound change in the way information is moving around society. That's the literacy and the digital era part. I'll give you a case study in a digital publishing project, some how-tos, though this really isn't enough time to train you how to do it, but at least to get you interested. And then I'm introducing this new thing called these Flipbix mini books, and you're kind of a market research group for me. By the way, I'm just going to pause for a second. You know, we've got some chairs down front, and I would not be offended if you guys just took a moment while I get a little drink here, and I would hate to see you standing. It's bad enough I have to stand. Why should you? Okay. Reflective question. You know, what is literacy in the 21st century? What does that mean? Come on down. We've got some here and here. Yeah. And I think sort of in alignment with that question, how do we really prepare our students for a future that we really don't understand? I guess I'd like to share with you some thoughts, my thoughts about literacy in the 21st century, as well as ideas I've borrowed from people like Alan November and David Warlick and lots of people that I think are doing great work in technology. I think one of the things that's happened that's a profound change is that technology has really put kids in charge of information, or really put potentially anyone, but certainly as early adopters and kids that have grown up in this environment, they can access the information they want when they want it. And that's profoundly different than the information environment that all of us were raised in. I think literacy is being redefined. I think this model works for me. As far as the ability to, first of all, find information and then decode it and then critically evaluate it and ultimately organize it, be creative with it, share it with others. This is what literacy means today. Someone once said that life's become an open book test. You know, we don't have to walk around remembering a lot of things anymore. I think what we need is the skill set that allows us to effectively utilize information. And this flow of information's changed, I think, in part from a very top-down model, which is the model that we grew up with. You know, there was the evening news, and there were three stations when I was a kid. In fact, when I was really young, there were only two stations. And at 6:30 at night, the news came on. Originally, the national news was only 15 minutes. Then it went to 30. And that's where you got your news. And you got your news from the newspaper, and we went to the movies, and when we were watching Gunsmoke in the early 60s, there we have some senior citizens here that saw that too. Gunsmoke got 70% of the audience when it was on. 70%. American Idol, which is a top show now, is getting 28% of the audience. There is no mass audience anymore. The audience has been fractionalized by the new media. And I think what's happened is it's moved information from this top down to a more horizontal model that's both personal and collaborative. Now, the personal side of it is that anybody can go get whatever information they want when they want to get it. It's as simple as that. Okay? You are potentially your own researcher and entertainment director. It doesn't matter where you live. You don't have to be in a city that's got a great library or in a university town. You can just go get information. If you have broadband, you can get it. And the other side of that is it's created this collaborative environment, these digital communities, these people that have an opportunity to relate to someone not simply because they live in the same geographic area as they do, but relate to them because they share a common interest. And more importantly, just relating to them, actually collaborate with them and be productive. Okay? So I think these are two really profound changes that have altered the information landscape. Now, I think most importantly is that instead of becoming passive consumers of information, we are now creators. or perhaps repackagers of information, taking something and doing a mashup of it into something else. This is this copy-paste world that we live in. And this is the world that our kids know. This is the only place they've ever lived. And you really have to reflect on that, because for you, it's still kind of this new thing. For them, it's the world. It's life. That's what you do with information. Okay? Right now, over half the teens in America that have access to the internet have their own, produced content for the internet. What the boys tend to be doing is remixing content, existing content. Girls tend to be authoring their own blogs. So this is more than half the kids. And there's such a low barrier to entry now that, you know, if we were on the internet right now, you could have your own blog created in 10 minutes if you've got something to say. Okay? You can be posting your images online. You can be putting your music online, whatever. And as much as people put down MySpace as kind of this trashy place with, you know, who's got the hottest abs, there's a lot of quality material there. You know, this is the space the kids are flocking to now where they're creating their own websites. And it's popular because it gives kids the tools to express themselves. That's why it's popular. It's as simple as that. See, and I thought we were supposed to be doing that in school. So I thought that was our job. And it turns out Rupert Murdoch now owns that. Okay? And they go there because they can map the landscape of their lives and share it with their peers. It's as simple as that. See? And my goal is to move that back into the school. Now, just like to talk briefly about print-on-demand publishing, because I'm going to be sharing some sample books with you, but we have to see if you know anything about it. Just a little test case here. Has anyone here ever gone to Lulu and published a book? Okay, well, I guess I'll sound smart with that group then, because no one has. How about going to some place like Shutterfly or the Kodak site or something and made a calendar or made a little book of your pictures? A few of you have done that. Okay, that's digital publishing, okay? And by uploading a digital file and essentially getting it to what's called an iGen printer, which is something developed by Xerox from Rochester, which is where I'm from, they can produce books. Books like these, books like paperback books, thick paperback books, whatever you want. And if you wanted to right now, you could open up a free account at lulu.com. You could log in. And you could upload a PDF of the text. Let's say you've written a 400-page novel, and you've converted it into a PDF, and you know what that is, an Adobe PDF. And you upload that as one file, and then you design a cover, and you create a JPEG or a GIF or a PNG file or something like that, which isn't too tricky. And you upload the cover, and then what they'll do is they'll produce the book. And the cost structure looks something like this. The basic cost of the book, I think, last I checked, was $4.53. Don't ask me why. It doesn't matter how long it is, how many pages, what shape it is, size, 6x9, 8.5x11, landscape, portrait, they don't care. Then it's 2 cents a page in black and white or 15 cents a page in color. And I'm talking about a full color book like this, okay? I mean, this is like a real book. And it's either perfect bound, if it's more than 50 pages, it's saddle stitched, if it's less than that. And then what you do is, as the author of the book, you can order one, or you can order 10. And you put in your credit card number, and they make the book as soon as you order it. It takes them about 4 or 5 days to make it. And then depending on what you pay to ship it, you know, you want the fast shipping, the slow shipping, you pay additional for that, and they send you the book, and it comes in the box, just like it came from Amazon. Now, the other thing they do is they create a web store for you, and if you want to sell the book to other people, you can either sell it at cost, or if you're a good capitalist and you want to mark it up, you can mark it up, and Lulu takes 20% of the markup, and you take 80%. They create their own little shopping cart there for you, and you have a little login to see how your book sales are going, and you are now an author. Now, if you really want to go big time, you can spend $35 extra and get an ISBN number, in which case it would be listed on Amazon and places like that. OK? kind of a low barrier to entry. Now, I started publishing some books there actually for a dear friend who's this 85-year-old author and kind of my surrogate father and mentor and all that, who had published lots of books that had been reviewed in the New York Times and the New York Review of Books and all over the place, but had been out of print for years. And he had these manuscripts are being rejected, and I said, Abe, we're going to self-publish. So we've already published 5 of his books. When I started doing that, I said, man, I should be doing this with kids. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm here today, is to help you see how to do that. Now, again, just some shots of the books here. I mean, this is one that I've got here. You can see that they're like real books. It's on quality paper. This is serious stuff. They're durable. You know, they're here, and I'll let you take a look if you want to come up at the end of class. This is the printer that they use. What I found out, I didn't know when I first started working with Lulu sends all their printing to Rochester, New York, where I'm from, because that's the home of the iGen printer. So now I've started working directly with a print shop, and I'll go down with a thumb drive and pop in a PDF, and I sort of print my own there. But you don't have to be in Rochester to do this. You can just do it from Lulu. Now let's talk a little bit about literacy, and then we'll get back to the books. To me, literacy is about constructing meaning. And see, I think publishing is a great tool to sort of capture that thinking that's going on. Now, we have to do this because research and data tells us that we've got a lot of struggling readers out there. In fact, the NAEP assessment shows that only about a third of our eighth graders are proficient readers. So we need to think of strategies where we can support not only content mastery, but acquisition of literacy. And see, I think publishing is good for the struggling reader especially. I mean, it's good for anybody. But it's good for the struggling reader because it really helps them sort of capture their thinking. It helps them go through the process of writing, through the planning stages. And ultimately, it's a great motivator. I mean, to see their work, it's very empowering. Now, I've actually done a lot of work with struggling readers. Here's just some typical comments that you might get from some struggling readers. Let's take Lauren for a minute. Lauren might be a word caller. A word caller is someone that can decode. They can actually read, and their reading sounds pretty good, but they can't comprehend what they're reading. They don't get it. And see, publishing is really good for them because it gives them practice in terms of all the organizational skills, the planning, the ability to make connections, the ability to think about audience and purpose, and to understand that reading and writing is more than just getting the words right. It's actually, you know, uncovering thinking, okay? So if you go to the website that I've pointed to you, Read, Think, Write, Publish, you can access a whole series of strategies for struggling readers, and you can actually download and print in PDF format a lot of activities that you can use with your kids. And there's both a teacher version and a student version of each. Okay, and they're strategies that work in any content area. And they target different types of struggling readers, from non-readers to word callers to reluctant readers. Now let's talk a little bit about rigor and relevance as just a sort of foundation for digital publishing. By rigor, what I'm talking about, and this is a model that we use a lot at the International Center. By rigor, I'm referring to Bloom's taxonomy. What level of Bloom's are we working at? And arbitrarily, we just divide it between the lower order of basic skills like knowledge, comprehension, and application, and the higher order thinking skills like analysis and synthesis and evaluation. Okay, so that's rigor. Now, on the relevance side, we're really talking about a couple things. One is we're talking about moving the kids' thinking and their processing from the sort of highly prescribed school environment, where many of them don't see how this relates to the real world, out to a much more real-world application, okay? A much more authentic application of the thinking. But the other dimension of this is not just authenticity. It's giving kids opportunities to actually think in independent ways as opposed to following highly prescribed teacher, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. You should get something that looks like step four. So when we talk about a high level of relevance, it's got both real world authenticity and it's very student centered. And the kids are the ones that are really figuring things out or kind of doing the messy work of it. So again, if we put rigor on a vertical scale here with an arbitrary division between lower order thinking and higher order thinking. And then on the relevant side, on the left of this dotted line, in quadrants A and C, we've got the sort of very highly prescribed school, this is how I want you to do it, teacher-centered, out to the much more student-based. Here, we get four intersection points. Okay? And in quadrant A, we're really talking about lower order thinking in a very highly prescribed, teacher-driven manner. Okay, that's quadrant A. Quadrant B is lower order thinking where students are sort of constructing the meaning or perhaps applying it in a real-world setting. Quadrant C is higher order thinking, again, in a very regimented school, this is how I want you to do it kind of manner. And finally, quadrant D, which is higher order thinking in a much more fluid, unpredictable, you've got to figure this out on your own environment. Now, I think that what ends up happening is when instruction centers a lot in quadrant A, what you're actually doing as a teacher is most of the work. See, that's how I used to teach when I first started. I gave lectures. I did five shows daily. Okay? And so I was the one that was doing all the reading, all the synthesizing of the information, and then I was sort of presenting it. Again, very much that gatekeeper model of information flow. I'm taking everything in. I'm sorting through it. I'm distilling it, evaluating it, and I'm doling it out to you in little bits and pieces. I think as you move into the other quadrants, you get other combinations of students doing the thinking and the work. By the way, you're still working very hard out here, but your work is typically happening before class. In other words, you've shifted from being the deliverer of information to being the architect of the learning environment. This is your new job, by the way. We've been repurposed in education. Now, I think it's very important that we put kids in charge of their own learning. And as a teacher, I always had these four bullets up on my bulletin board. This whole notion of kids being able to answer the question about what they're learning and why they're learning, and most importantly, how they can impact the quality of teaching and learning. And see, in any particular lesson, you've really got three major components in instruction. You've got the content, and we all know what that is, and that's very prescribed and defined, and it's in the textbooks and all that. And we think a lot about the product, which is what the kids are going to produce. But the challenging part for us is to get at the process. What are kids actually going to do to construct meaning? And one of the things that I like about publishing is it makes that second stage very visible. Now, I'd like to share with you an example, which is this book right here, which is Traveling Through the Human Body with ABCs. Okay? Now, this was done as part of a sixth grade project. These were sixth graders that were, as part of the New York State standards, had to learn the functions of the organ of the body. And the process part was we asked them to summarize the function and to actually design a comparison. And the product, of course, was a book, and we designed an ABC book, which we then took over to a third grade class and read to the kids. Okay, there. Now, as far as the instructional design, what the teacher was really doing, first of all, was modeling the whole process, and then the student teams chose the organ, restated the function. They developed their own comparisons. They eventually did the analogies and the visual comparisons, and then really tried to put it in their own terms. Okay. Now, there's a great research foundation to this, which is the fact that the single most effective strategy you can use to improve student content mastery is by having kids develop comparisons. Okay? And so this is something that has a research base to it. It works. It actually helps kids learn the content material that we wanted them to learn. And this is just an example of what some of the kids did. So this is what Holly and Serena did. They had K, and they picked kidney, and then they compared a kidney to a pool filter. And as you can see, in order to do this, you have to know how a kidney functions. But at the same time, by doing this, you actually cement in your own thinking the function of the kidney. Okay? So this is both a creative task and a learning tool. Now, of course, we always ask kids to reflect on what they're learning. And we ask teachers to reflect, too. This is one of the groups of kids that was doing this. We ask them questions, for example, like restating the process. Go through the process. What steps did you follow? And what I especially like about this one student who said, then we read everything over to see if it made sense to our audience. I mean, think about that, a sixth grader thinking about audience and purpose. Why? Well, because they knew that they were producing something authentic, and their name was going to be on it. We asked them to reflect on what they learned about themselves. Well, somebody learned here that Jimmy is mean and controlling, but they also learned about working with other people because they worked in teams, and there was a whole editorial process and a peer review process where they're looking at each other's work and what's going to go in the book and what isn't. So, I mean, some very powerful understanding, highly relevant about their own reflection on their learning. And, of course, we asked the teachers to reflect. And what was interesting there is the teachers were telling us that they essentially got to see how their students were thinking, the kind of process that they followed. So, again, it's very valuable for teachers, and it improves their understanding of their kids and their understanding of their craft. Now, it's important to know that this is not an add-on. Okay, we don't have time to do anything else as teachers. Our plates are too full. So if this is going to work, it's got to be something you're already doing. And in this case, the kids were facing a sixth grade state test in science that included the functions of the human body, the various organs. All right? So this was valuable. This was time well spent for those classes because those kids scored very well in that section of the test. And in this case, the technology was not the goal. See, I don't want to integrate technology any more than I want to integrate pencils. Okay? We spend far too much time thinking about integrating technology. I just want to get things done. And if there's a program or a piece of hardware that'll help us do things better or see things or learn better, then I want to use it. It's as simple as that. Now, just to give you an idea of a more enhanced set of projects I did, for the past couple years, I've been working for the New York State Office of Children and Family Services, and they manage the student juvenile detention centers around New York State. So they've got about 3,000 kids that are incarcerated. And some of them are minimum security facilities. They might only be 25 beds. For example, there's some up in the Adirondack Mountains that combine outdoor wilderness training, and these are usually gang kids. Some of them are high security facilities that look every bit like an adult prison with lockdowns, barbed wire, violent sexual offenders, kids that have murdered somebody. I mean, it runs the gamut. They're boys and girls. They might be as young as 12 years old. They might be up to 21. So I was working with the teachers and with the students. And I had done the staff development for about a year and a half, and they wanted me to sign on for another year. And I said, I don't want to just teach teachers, in the workshop, because that's kind of an artificial environment. I want to get back into the classroom. I want to look at student work, and I want to turn that into a product that we can talk about. So I said to the people up in Albany, the state capital, gee, why don't we publish some books? And they kind of looked at me and said, our kids publish books? Our teachers? Come on, they don't have time. They aren't interested. I said, okay, I'm going to bet you they are. And so what I did is I went down to a nearby facility, the Harriet Tubman facility, which had girls incarcerated in it. And I said, girls, let's publish a book. So we did. And we had some real struggling learners. I mean, we had kids with like a second grade reading level, special ed kids. And I mean, this was not this wellspring of talent. And so we published a book like one of these, and then we had an author signing where the girls signed them and dedicated them to the teachers all around the state saying, your kids can do this. So the next time I went down to meet with the teachers, I just brought a stack of these books and said, take a look. You want to make one of these? They all melted, said, we got to do this, and off the project went. So I spent about another year and a half doing that, along with some fellow consultants, and we used to do these road trips around the state to all these facilities. Now, the teachers found this to be one of the most rewarding experiences they had ever done with their kids. I mean, they were really wowed. And you'll see some pictures of the students. This is a facility that's run like a military camp. This is actually the most secure facility in the state, these kids. I never asked what they had done. I didn't want to know. But they had done some stuff that was pretty serious. Now, as far as getting started, again, you got to capture what you're already doing. It's not an add-on. You've got to identify the learning. You have to identify an audience, a purpose. What are you going to do with this book? For example, one of the things that we came up with was writing children's books, in large part because these kids don't have very high reading levels. We treated the students like authors. You've got to give kids models of previous publications. You've got to inspire them. Keep the writing process going, and you can have a very, very productive workshop. Kids love getting in and editing and so forth. We really tried to let the kids handle as much of the process as possible. Okay, again, we wanted it very, very student-centered. And there's some tools. I've thrown in some techie tips in here along the way. One of the tools as far as editing, this is already in Word, and I don't know if you've ever used it, but if you go to Tools, Track Changes, and Highlight Changes, then as you make an edit, as you delete this phrase, it actually keeps it in there and it crosses it out in red. When you add something in an edit, it underlines it in red. And you can have little call-out boxes on the side that says so-and-so made, whoever logged into the file made this change on such and such a date. You can track all the changes that are going on. And the other wonderful thing is if you go into Tools and you go to your options and then you pick spelling and grammar, you can show readability statistics, and the next time you spell check any text, it'll give you a very accurate reading level. So again, this is very useful for the kids to see. It's very useful for you to check the kinds of material that you're sharing with kids. I mean, you can go to the internet and copy some text, paste it into a Word document, and you can do a readability level check on it like that. That's in Word. Yeah, and it's there already. Yeah. I mean, anything in the last three or four. I mean, maybe if you have Word 1980 or something, it's not in there. Then the thing you really have to do is you have to include reflection in this. These are three critical questions I think you can always ask kids. You know, what did you think when we got started? And it's fascinating. I remember we were working with some vocational ed kids, and we had them writing about it, and one of the kids wrote, they're putting writing where it doesn't belong. I like that. The steps they followed, and ultimately, what did you find out about yourself as a learner? And those are very, very powerful questions. And it's remarkable the answers you get. For example, this is one of the incarcerated kids, Jaquan. We realized very quickly that many of these incarcerated kids, and I'm using them as an example, but I hope you see this would work with any group of students. So this is not the incarceration only talk here, but many of this group of kids are already parents. I mean, they're 15, 16, 17, and they've already got kids, or they've got one on the way. Jaquan was one that had a kid on the way. And we sort of hooked him with the idea that he wanted to know if his child was developing in the right way. So as part of a project that we were doing on the human body, Jaquan got to do some research on human development in utero. That he was really fascinated with. But I love some of the comments that he makes here about initially saying, show my talent. I can't show my talent in science. I'm a basketball player. Okay? Or later on, he talks about how involved he was, how he'd walk into class, he'd get his materials. Before I knew it, it would be time to go. Some days I would even hold up the class and say, wait, could I write a couple more sentences? Imagine a kid saying that to you. Don't stop class. I want to write some more. And, of course, what we did, we kind of hit on this by accident, but we realized that since many of these kids were parents, it would be great if they wrote children's books, and then we put the children's books in the waiting rooms. So now when you go around New York State to some of the facilities, you'll see books written by the incarcerated kids for their own children, okay, which was a real motivator. Now, the teachers reflected and just felt that this was probably one of the most profound experiences that that they had had a chance to do as a teacher. And I've worked with not only teachers of the incarcerated kids, but kids on the outside, you know, all kids. And the experience I get from teachers is just so exciting. I mean, teachers really love this. The parents like it. The school board likes it. Everybody likes it because you're making kids think invisible. Now, you might say, well, gee, what program do you use? Well, you know, if you've used PageMaker or, you know, some of these programs are really tough. So we do all these books in PowerPoint. You know, normally when you project a PowerPoint slide, you know, you set it at 40 font or 60 or something. Well, you can set it at 8 or 10. And I don't know if you've ever tried to put an image in Word and then manage multiple pages, but the alignment gets thrown off. It's crazy. And it starts jumping around, and you have to tight alignment, and then you get to the next page, and the page breaks in the wrong spot. Guess what? PowerPoint does that beautifully. You want to talk about your page setup? You got a slide sorter view. So all the pages of your book are right there. You want to change the order? I mean, try and do that in Word. Try and take a page out of here in Word and put it over there. Forget it. PowerPoint, just drag it over. No problem. The other thing is it's already on the computers. And guess what? Most of you kind of know how to use it, or you might be very good at it, and the kids all know it. So it's a great publishing tool. For example, let's say you have different kids working on different parts of the book, and these kids are going to do just one page, these kids are going to do another page, these guys are going to do another page. You can merge work from different PowerPoints by going to Insert Slides from File, and then you navigate to the other PowerPoint where you want to get the slides. You pick the slides you want. You can pick slide 6, slide 7, not pick 8. And you can check this box that says Keep Source Formatting, so if this other PowerPoint used a certain style or design, it won't get changed when you import it into this new one, unless, of course, you want it to. So you can keep, kids can all work on separate ones, and then you can merge them all into one book. Okay? Now, the other thing, of course, is that we're used to thinking as PowerPoint as a landscape ratio, aspect ratio. But if you go into page setup, you can choose for your notes and handouts or for the slides either portrait or landscape. So you can make books that look like this. This is a PowerPoint book, okay? So this is PowerPoint in portrait format. And by the way, Lulu has an easier time publishing them this way than in landscape. So that's kind of why I've been doing them this way, too. There it is in, I mean, that's this book. That's a screenshot from this book. Yeah?
So can I use your PowerPoint that you're teaching us to teach my kids? Is this stuff on your website?
A lot of it is. In fact, this book, you can actually get a copy of this book. And not because I'm interested in selling it, because I'm really not making any money on it. But I think kids need to see something to get excited. So you can do that. And I'm in the process of putting this all step by step online. I've been on the road for the whole summer. And this is kind of my newest thing that I got excited about. So I still have to get back home, sit still for a while, and write this up and put it online so all the steps are there. But quite honestly, if you can do PowerPoint, you can do this. And so I'm hoping that some of you will be early adopters. Yeah, question?
I don't want to stay too far away from what you're talking about, that image up there. I don't imagine that's student-generated.
That's a very important question. And one of the things that we did is we searched for copyright-free clip art. And you know what's interesting? When kids saw their books in print, they suddenly got very interested in copyright. Wow. Somebody going to steal my book? You know? It was fascinating how that worked. Wow. Anyway, moving on. Another thing that happens in PowerPoint is file size gets really big. You know, you take this digital picture, you stick it in there. Something you may not know is you click on the picture, you get the picture toolbar, you click on this little thing here called Compress Picture, and it reduces the resolution down to like 200 dpi, which is all you need for a book. Because if you took this big, you know, you have your 25 megapixel camera, you know, and you took this picture and you stick it in PowerPoint, guess what? It's still this big honking file. It's gigantic. And now suddenly your PowerPoint's like 30 meg and you can't email it to anybody and you can't do anything with it. It you know, won't even fit on your thumb drive. So PowerPoint allows you to manage text. You know, we talk about contrast, repetition, alignment, proximity, some key elements of design. I don't have time to do a design. And yes, it does spell C-R-A-P, which is how I always remember it. Anyway, but just some samples from some books. This is this wilderness group that's up in the Adirondacks, and they did poetry. But again, just to show you something done by teachers and kids in PowerPoint, just some screenshots, and you can look at the books in a while. Repetition of font, repetition of color scheme, playing with alignment, scanned in a digital picture that a kid did, a drawing, split it in two, put it on opposite sides of the poem. This is another book, How Life is Like Clay. This is from another facility that's kind of run like a military academy. They brought in a potter, and then the kids read Ode to a Grecian Urn, and then they wrote a poem, and they made a pot. It was a great project. But again, the idea of keeping the text small, not using things like bullets, trying to tell the story with digital pictures. Again, this is all done in PowerPoint. Using some shapes and fills. You know, there's all sorts of shape tools. Maybe superimposing things over a visual. This is actually one of the poems that the kids wrote. It became the title of the book. They picked that. I mean, this is a very rigorous and relevant activity for teachers and kids. This is exactly what we're talking about. Certainly as far as money, doesn't cost a lot. I mean, you know, you could probably just use district funds, but do a little partnership with a community library. We typically, when we're working in the school setting, every class makes their own book. We publish only three or four of each one. One stays in the classroom. One goes to the school library. One goes to the school board. You know, you got to do that. Or goes to the principal's office. And the last one goes to the community library so kids can go in with their parents and check out their own books. You don't have to make 1,000. You can make two of them. You can make one if you want. Okay? Now, not because I'm trying to sell these books, but I think it really helps to show people one. If you want to go to my website, you can actually download one of these books as a sample, and you'll steer to something like this. Little credit card, it's $12.95. Add to the cart. And within, you know, depending on the shipping, you can have one of these books in your hands in a week or 10 days. And then if you want to go in and show your kids and say, how'd you like to make this? Or go to your principal and say, how about giving us $50 to do this, you know? I mean, that's not so much money. There's a sample book. I've also got another one online. This is the Writing Buddy Project. These are second graders, which is another whole thing. It's based on six plus one writing. It's got all the kids in here and stuff they've written. I didn't put any of some of these other ones I have here that are, these are incarcerated kids. I didn't think I wanted to put those online. Now, I did want to show you something else called Flip Picks. And maybe you heard about these. Have you heard about these little things? Anyone mentioned them to you? So this is a brand new project. While I was dealing with all the publishers of this stuff, somebody turned me on to this guy that's got this little program and this special kind of paper. And he was actually producing like business cards like this. And I said, wait a minute, we've got to use these in education. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pass one out, or pass these out to you. So if somebody could help me here, and we got a bunch of them, and maybe you could help pass those around, and we'll put some back here, and you could sort of pass those that way, and pass these over this way. This is what a Flip Picks looks like. Okay? This is one in action. This is my wife modeling the use of a Flip Picks, but you can't see her right now. Okay, see what these things do, and I don't know if you've got one in your hands yet, but let's get some over here in the front here. Could you give me a few of these here? Give me these here. Take some here. Okay. Now, what is great about these is. That's all I've got. Sorry. I tried to print up a bunch of them and bring them. But what they do is they just sort of continually fold. So if you've got one, pass it on. Let someone else get a closer look. And I'm sort of curious to see what your response to these is, because I think they've got a real educational application. There's a little piece of software that you put on your computer, and what it allows the kids to do is to pick these four different faces, and they can put whatever image that they want in, they can put whatever text that they want in, and they can put the image over the text, they can put the text, they can put the text over the image, they can put the text around the image, and so forth. They get to pick font styles, they get to crop pictures, they can do whatever they want with it. So they can take this picture and just use the kid's face. They can add text, like in this case, the pool filter, they can pop that in. And the real neat thing about this is that it prints to a regular sheet of paper, but it prints to any printer on a special paper. So let me just show you how this works. This is, you see, a sheet of paper, and what I have to do is just give it a couple starter folds here, like this, 1 second. Okay, so I just give it a couple starter folds like that, crease it, okay. Then on the back, I peel off one part like this. Then I peel off the other one like this. Okay, see, and I get something that looks like that. Then I very carefully fold this over once, fold it over again, press it down like that. Now I got something like this, then I go like that. And now I've got one. Here. Okay? Now, well, my question to you, I'll tell you where this thing stands right now. I've got this guy that normally sells this stuff commercially to print, printing shops to make like wedding invitations and whatever, and business cards. I think these would work in schools. What do you think? I mean, wouldn't you do this? What? Well, I don't think it's going to become Rubik's Cube or anything, but I'm just curious because I told them that I was going to be speaking here on some other digital publishing things, but I kind of share them with the audience and get their impression. So do you see these as having an educational application? Yeah? They're cool? Okay. I've used the software, and I've got a little tune-up. There's a few things I'm going to suggest that he changes, but it basically runs on any computer. You print to any printer, and I guess the only deal is you got to buy the special paper, which I think is going to end up probably in the vicinity of like 40 or 50 cents a sheet or something like that, which doesn't seem to me. I mean, that wouldn't be a deal killer, right? Yeah. So. What I suggest you do, in fact, I was just on the phone with them again this morning because I shared this with the group yesterday and I got a very positive response. And I said, well, I'll see what these guys think. But if you do think it's something that you'd like to get your hands on, drop me an email. I'm just creating a little sort of starter list so that I can put you in touch with this guy if he decides to put these on the market. But I do think they're very cool. Now, the essential question. How do we prepare our kids for a world we cannot describe? Well, you know what I think would be very cool? I think it's a great idea to give them authentic publishing projects, opportunities to see themselves as creators of content. The other great thing I love about these books is that, I'm all for blogs and putting things online, but in the school environment, that's kind of a real scary thing to do, and you have so much more control using something like this. And so I think these are very, very powerful projects. I really think that it's something that can give kids a chance to express their creativity and to really do some authentic thinking. Again, you can go to the website. At this point, You can actually order one of these books or these books just to see. I'm in the process of putting a more step-by-step guide there, but guess what? It ain't rocket science. If you go to Lulu, they've got all kinds of wizards there that guide you through. The other thing is, if you're interested in having me maybe come to your school or something, or really doing a much more intensive workshop or talking, you want me to talk to your principal and get them to come up with some money, whatever, certainly contact me. There's a lot of other material on my website that I think you'll find very useful. Now, we've got a little bit of time left over, and I do know we've got another session coming in here, and they've got to set up some videotaping, but if you would like to come up here and take a look at one of these books, you can. So they're up here. I cannot give them to you to keep, unfortunately, because I need them as demo models. So please come up and take a look, and I think you can keep those. Unfortunately, I do not have any more, so I wish I did.
Can you see if anybody
is
in the same school district?
Yeah, if somebody could share one because they've got one from the same district, it'd be great. But thank you all very much. Just checking out the back room. I've got to grab something. It's mine right there. There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.